Page 47, the poem is the Nine Gates series, which is a really beautiful poem. I didn't read that last night. And it's...
Well, it's first of all, it's nine poems long.
Right.
And each one of those poems is a meditation and should be meditated on.
Stu would be here tonight. It would be nice to hear it read sometime. Anyway, the last bit of this whole poem, well, the last bit of number eight, I guess it is, yeah, is guy standing by me at a Levertov reading 20 years ago, whispers in my ear, she reads just like she talks, except her voice seems to come from somewhere else. So it's a great anecdote. And, you know, to me, it also goes to what she and Robert Duncan were talking about in the early 60s in their correspondence about organic poetry. And that goes to Robin Blazer's essay, The Practice of Outside, this notion that the source of the poem is outside of us. Even if it's in a truss of the language to go where it needs to go, there's this kind of sublimation to something bigger, in this case, the process. And with her, not just with the writing, but with the actual reading of it. In public.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Tell us about it.
I mean, all of us who are real poets, when we read the poem, there's a different quality in the voice, even though the tone of the voice and the words are the same tone and words. And that's what the poetry itself does with the voice. I mean, it's the music of the mind moving among the 10,000 things. Also from this same sequence, before poetry was called poetry, what was its name? Before truth was a word, there was still truth, and it had a name. Sher Shuang, writing long ago, thought words were expedient means. Buddhas are born of necessity. Sher Shuang himself must have groped along. So words are expedient means, but they're not the result. They're not a consequence. They're not an arrival. They're a means.
An approximation.
And words evolve and change, and meanings change. A poem is, in its own way, a provisional conclusion.
Provisional.
Provisional.
It's the best you can achieve in the moment.
Yeah.
How does Denise fit into the grand scheme? When the history of West Coast or Pacific Rim poetics is written, how does Denise fit in?
Elusively. First of all, she's not a West Coaster. I once criticized her for too many inversions in a poem. And she laughed at me and she said, you just don't understand. I have a mid-Atlantic accent. You know, she was born and raised in England and came to America and spent most of her life living in Boston and Maine and New York. And then moved late in her life to Seattle. But her poetics, as her huge correspondence with Robert Duncan makes abundantly clear, is primary philosophical material for West Coast poetry. And she was, you know, a projective verse poet, an organic poet. Her essays on organic poet, both of them are absolutely wonderful.
Some notes on organic form,
yeah,
and the function of the line, those two specifically.
Yeah.
You've already done your spiel on line breaks, so people can probably refer to that because you've done it enough. But too many poets are writing mediocre prose broken up into line breaks. And if you can have that clever kind of end, that's their notion, the typical notion of line breaks. But it's a lot deeper than that.
One of the dangers of workshopping is that you learn to rely on things like wit. If you can make something witty and you'll get a kind of immediate response. But it's only immediate, and in a way it's a kind of low-grade response. It's kind of a cheap response. I said of the Nine Gates that they were meditations and they needed to be meditated on, and that's why I didn't read them. I mean that in a very serious way. Workshops tend to produce groupthink, And we tend to start writing like one another because we're getting together, you know, twice a week or once a week and spending hours going over our poems. And I mean, there's some good in that back and forthness of it, but there's also this risk of groupthink and of relying simply on a poetry of wit and not thinking carefully about the process of being a poet. And that is, you know, how do you find and follow what's given? And poetry is, after all, above all else, it's a gift. It's a gift to the poet from the muse, that thing we call inspiration, which the poet, in the act of being a poet, a maker, transforms in order to give it away so that someone can hear the poem, read the poem, feel the poem, and want to respond to that poem by saying, oh, I can't wait to give this away. So it really is a condition of gift economics. But it's a gift that also comes with a certain responsibility. And if your primary goal is to be popular, workshops are a really good thing because you find out what works in the workshop. But if your design is not simply to be popular, but to really deeply engage a tradition, then that workshop is a distraction more than anything else because it's drawing you away from the tradition that you should be excavating, like an archaeologist. You should be studying these stones instead of wetting your finger and seeing which way the wind blows.
Like Olson calling one of his books Archaeologist of Mourning.
Yeah, yeah.
And you...
Well, as you know, he was a very good amateur archaeologist.
Yeah, going to the digging into the Mayan culture was part of that. Yeah. So when we get into that groupthink, we're also conditioning ourselves not to recognize the peculiar gifts that the muse has for us as individuals, and unable to really achieve our deepest gesture as an individual in that way. That's part of what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. There's a story you've told before, and in this latest iteration of this, or maybe this is the first time you've said it in poetry, I'm not sure. I've heard you tell the story before. A Word in Farsi is the poem on page 51. From the Chinese Xi, poetry is the word for word married to the word for temple. The temple, or a pictograph of the hand reaching down, cradling a seedling. So you tell the story here that also goes to the old logo of that company you used to work for. So maybe you can... That itself is also a rough translation of what the Chinese word for poet or pictograph for poetry really means.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it exactly? I mean, if you can make it literal. You've told me this before. The temple of word, the sound of...
Well, poetry is a temple of words. A temple made of words.
And the literal translation in English would be
poetry.
Not the sound of the man's the mouth of the man who cradles the seed, or something like that.
I don't know what you're remembering, but
well, where's the seed? The hand is reaching down, cradling a seedling. So how does that?
Well, there's a hook on the bottom of this character. And what that hook represents is the hand reaching down with the seedling in it, that is about to plant the seed. So that poetry is where seeds get planted, or poetry is a planting of seeds, you might say. But you can also say that poetry is a temple. That's a wonderful thing about Chinese etymology. You can get hooked on this shit like Ezra Pound did and get completely off track. But that particular character, I think, is quite wonderful. The character for word combined with the character for temple to get poetry.
Well, one last main subject here. One of the later poems in the book, poem on his 63rd birthday. Second stanza, I did not choose to be born in springtime, the briefest season, but I may choose the day I die, if reason dictates such a choice be made. And a day like this one would suffice, which goes back to the saying that we associate with Native American warriors, today is a good day to die. Is that you proclaiming your warrior nature, also proclaiming your rights as a person who says, "Look, I'm going to do a Kevorkian thing if I have to."
The latter. I'm not a warrior, and I find that the sort of the warrior language, warrior culture, really bothers me a lot.
Even the spiritual warrior?
You can't be a spiritual warrior. You can't. Being a warrior is antithetical to spiritualism.
Antithetical.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because warrior implies aggression, and spiritualism requires acceptance.